So it's been a funny start to the new year, hasn't it?
Yeah, fed up with it already. Boy,
we're all
still
locked down.
Yeah, I'm still wearing my Christmas socks, though.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I haven't changed.
Well, you've not washed them yet?
No, I haven't changed them once.
Okay, listen, but I mean, I guess we're locked down, aren't we? So we're limited in terms of how much travel we can do. But one thing about living in Wiltshire is that even from your doorstep, you've got places you can walk to, no matter where you are, really.
Yeah, we should think ourselves lucky.
So welcome to the Hidden Wiltshire podcast. We're now onto podcast two. This is Glyn Coy. I live in Wiltshire and I take photographs.
And I'm Paul Timlett. I also live in Wiltshire and take photographs most of the time.
So we're now onto the second podcast. The first one we did was of the Wiltshire Warminster skyline, I should say. And it's quite well received, actually. We had a lot of listens. Something like 500, which I was quite pleased with. From all over the world, in fact, as well, not just Wiltshire.
Yeah, astonishing. I mean, never mind 500. I thought 5 would have been a good result.
Yeah, I would have been happy with 5.
But of South Africa. Well, that was my friend Debbie. Japan, US, I think, Canada, and then all over Europe.
Yeah, all over the place. Malta, UAE. I mean, we've got a multinational following already. That's quite impressive.
Extraordinary. An international podcast.
But actually, I mean, the good thing about doing the first podcast and having that much engagement means that we got some feedback. Some of it was very positive, but we had a couple of people that gave us some constructive criticism, I would say, Paul. So do you want to address that?
Yeah. One of them, I mean, I think what I've liked about doing this, and okay, it's only episode 2, but I think, you know, we've had some fun doing it, and you know, it can be lighthearted, but also, you know, we're sharing knowledge. I mean, that's what we're about at the end of the day. Yeah. In the first episode, I made a remark which was sarcastic and flippant. It was made in complete innocence, but I had an email, fortunately, from a friend of mine who said you might have caused some upset about a remark you made, and it was a comment I made about the traffic lights on the A36 at Upton Lovell, and I said that there must be somebody important living there to get the traffic lights. And as my friend Dave pointed out to me, he sent me some newspaper clippings, and it's at that spot. It's actually a horrendous black spot for car crashes. And tragically, in 2012, two Upton Lovell residents were actually killed at that crossroad. Actually, quite well-known residents, Anthony Barrington Brown, who was a photographer and explorer, and his wife, Althea Barrington Brown, who was a sculptor. And the villagers have been campaigning for about 20 years to get that junction sorted out. There's all sorts of other horrendous crashes there. One where a little girl was, I think, airlifted to hospital. That's why those traffic lights are there, and for damn good reason. There's also a 40-mile-an-hour limit along that whole stretch. I was quite upset that I, when I thought about it, I actually knew about the crash, and I'd sort of mentioned it in a blog I'd written for Hidden Wiltshire, one of the first blogs I ever wrote, I think, for Hidden Wiltshire, and I'd just completely forgotten about it. So if anybody heard that and was upset by it, you know, I'm extremely sorry to have caused that upset, and it's even more disappointing because I've spent so long campaigning on traffic issues around here where I live. So for it to come from me, of all people, is huge apologies for anybody not intended.
It's interesting as well, because I did a quick Google search on that and discovered there's been a load of accidents there over the years. So it really is a black spot. I mean, that road itself is really busy. And now there are other areas which are not so safe. But anyway, I think it's good for us to correct the record on that.
And I think
a couple of people said, I was quite surprised about this, but I think it's an interesting how people interpret what you say. But a couple of people kind of made the point that they felt we were being a bit negative about the MOD on Salisbury Plain, which is not our intention, actually.
No, not at all. And in fact, today's episode, which we'll get into in a minute, is very solidly based on Salisbury Plain. And it was another friend of mine who raised this. Fortunately, my good walking buddy, Stuart, who lives next door, who was ex-army, and he's I think been a bit hard on the army and the MOD, because I think I made reference to the fact that Bowles Barrow out on the Imber Range had sort of driven a tank over it and that sort of thing, which they have, but it's worth pointing out that if it weren't for the MOD and the army on Salisbury Plain, it would be a very different place, and it would probably be completely covered in housing. And the army, the MOD do a fantastic job in conservancy and archaeology. And again, we're very lucky to have that on our doorstep. And we've got a pretty unique environment, and it wouldn't be that way if it wasn't for the MOD.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. So this week, we're going to talk about a couple of things. Later on, we're going to talk about the lost village of Imber, which isn't really lost because it still exists, but there's an interesting story about what happened to it. But before we get there, I wanted to kind of push beyond those hills we talked about last time, Battlesbury and Scratchbury, and further over Salisbury Plain towards Nook. Now, Nook is a place you probably pass through when you drive along the A36, and there's an army camp there. But in the hills above there, there are some fantastic remains of old villages, and there's a hill fort up there. Well, it's called a hill fort, but I'll talk a little bit more about what that actually means for that area, because it's not quite the same scale as Scratchbury. But we have a hill fort up there called Nook Castle, which isn't too well known about. And I believe you walked up that way recently, Paul.
Yeah, the aforementioned Stuart, my next door neighbour, and I sort of went out there. I think it must have been maybe November is when sort of lockdown was a bit more relaxed. And so we actually drove out there, whereas at the moment I'm not driving anywhere to go for a walk. We did a walk out that way. I'm trying to remember where the walk was. Yeah, it was from Chitton. We started from Chitton, that's right, and came up over sort of Breakheart Bottom and that way. And we stopped off at Nook Camp, and it's become a bit of a tradition with Stu and I. We sort of take our lunch and a flask of coffee and a little hip flask with us. So we were sitting on the earthworks at Nook Castle, sort of thinking about the past and, you know, the number of people that would have lived up there and farmed around there back in the Iron Age. But it was ironic because I've never seen so many people up there than that day, because it was, talking about the army, there was a little sort of army bivouac behind us. They had all sorts of communication masts up and they were bivvy down in the woods. And I've never seen so many people up there that day.
It can get really busy up there with the army, because I know when I go up that way, I go from the other side. I stop around Nook Camp, because just next to that is Dunscombe Bottom, where I do some livestock spotting at various times of the year for Wiltshire Wildlife Trust. And often there, it can be very quiet when the camp's empty. But when they have, some kind of army manoeuvre on or some kind of exercise, the camp can be packed full of squaddies. And the traffic going up onto the plain is amazing to watch. It's almost like they transport, a whole division of the army into this camp for a weekend. Lorries, tanks, everything.
Talking about sort of dangerous roads as we were earlier on, I mean, it's being just off the A36, you get people sort of hurtling off that junction from the A36 at Heytesbury and heading up towards Chitton on the B390. You go straight past the camp there and as you say, when it's full, I mean, they even have to have guys sort of marshalling the crossing as all the troops cross from one side of the road to the other.
Yeah, and funny enough, just talking about that, I've just had some inspiration there for another podcast in the future. You mentioned Breakheart Bottom. I mentioned Dunscan Bottom, and it reminded me of how
Bottoms.
Wiltshire likes bottoms.
Yes.
And there's nothing rude about that. It just seems to be a word that we use in Wiltshire for a valley of some kind.
It's a sort of dry valley. I mean, you'd also call it a coombe. So the word coombe is you'll see that a lot on maps. Coombe you see all over the place. You see that word used to describe a dry valley. But I'm not sure about bottoms. Perhaps it's just a Wiltshire thing.
Well, as I say, we'll do some research on that and maybe revisit it in a future podcast. But yeah, there are an awful lot of bottoms. And most of them are very picturesque and good for photography.
Actually, we guarantee a lot more listeners if we publicise that one.
Yeah, put that in the show notes.
Yeah, this week we're going to talk about bottoms.
that might come up in certain searches on Apple. Anyway, back onto topic. So when I did this walk, I walked up from Dunscan Bottom and walked across the roads over Nuck Down towards Nuck Castle. And it's a very, it's marked on the Ordnance Survey maps. It's a very distinctive shape. And if there are some aerial photos of it out there, so you can, I think there's one on our website, Hidden Wiltshire website, where you can see the distinctive shape of the earthwork. And it is an enclosure of some kind. It's not as dramatic as some of the other hill forts that you see, but I think it's led some people to suggest it might be some kind of a livestock enclosure, a defensive livestock enclosure. And when you think about what else is up there, that makes sense, because just to the north and to the east of Nuck Castle itself, there are two settlements marked on the map, and they are two quite separate Romano-British villages. One's called Nuck Down East, and one's regarded as or called Nuck Down West. And at ground level, there's not much to see, but if you know that they're there, you can look and see all sorts of undulations and earthworks in the landscape. And actually, when you're up there, you're pushing right against the edge of Imber Range and the danger area. So actually, the boundary of the danger area cuts right across these settlements. So there are parts of it you can see at ground level, but other parts are out of bounds. But it's just quite interesting, because it says to me that, you know, at that time, in that sort of Romano-British period, the first 400 years, Anno Domini, there were people up there. There were quite extensive settlements, and it would have been very busy. And that's very poignant when you go up there now, because it's oftentimes very quiet. There's not many people up there. And it's a very quiet landscape, being on the edge of the military area as well.
Yeah, I mean, Nuck Castle is what's described as, and correct me if I get the wrong pronunciation here, but a univalet earthwork.
Yeah.
In that there's one bank and ditch, whereas a lot of hill forts are sort of multivalet, I think they call it, where there's two or more banks and ditches. And the existence of just a single bank and ditch tends to point towards it being a livestock enclosure, as you said, although people would have presumably lived there to keep an eye on the livestock. So I guess if you were taking an aerial shot, you might see hut circles and stuff like that. But as you say, I mean, I'm just sort of looking at an OS map as you were speaking there, and you know, there were settlements and barrows and tumuli just marked all over the map, very close to Nuck Castle. Now, it's, you know, I think as we said in the previous podcast, it's very difficult to tell whether these were all occupied and used at the same time, or whether they were spread over sort of thousands of years. But
I think the archaeology does support that, because what I was reading is that when they've done digs around there, they've discovered things going back to the Neolithic. So you've got the Neolithic, Bronze Age, Iron Age, Romano-British period. So that's spread over thousands of years, concentrated into that area.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of these sort of monuments around there have been sort of excavated over the years in, by today's standards, would be a very poor fashion. So the late 18th century, I think the very famous William Cunnington, who lived in Heytesbury, and Sir Richard Colt Hoare of Stourhead fame. I mean, they were, I guess, yeah, they were amateur archaeologists, weren't they? And they sort of travel all around that area, excavating barrows and tumuli and you know, burial sites. In fact, I was reading about this last night, that apparently they followed a sort of an old track, a sort of corridor, which I saw described as old ditch. And it seems to run, and if you looked at an OS map, it seems to run from the northeast of Warminster, where you'll see a load of earthworks, a long line of earthworks shown on the map. And it goes just south of Bowles Barrow, and then the earthworks continue down to Nook Barrow and a sort of Nook Castle. So Cunnington and Colt Hoare excavated a lot of the sites along that route. So you know, they excavated, just looking at my notes here, wrote it down, Cotley Hill, which is one of your favourite places, isn't it?
Yep.
Next to Battlebury. And then, you know, Nook Bowles Barrow, Nook Castle, Nook Long Barrow, and then sort of continued over towards what was described as the Hollow Track, towards sort of Chitton and Tilshead. And they sort of excavated things as they kind of went along. Now, whether that's just a fanciful assumption based on where they excavated, you know, the fact that they were following this old track, or whether that's true, I don't know. But they certainly sort of dug into a lot of things there and made a lot of extraordinary finds. But because I guess sort of archaeology was not as advanced as it is now, and they didn't have the sort of the techniques and the equipment, you know, they did cause some damage on the way. But then that's what archaeology is. I mean, it is a fairly destructive process. Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm just sort of scanning across now, looking across to Breakheart Bottom that we mentioned earlier on, and Chitton, and I can see the earthworks continue over there across Breakheart Hill. I mean, the whole area is just covered in ancient monuments.
Yeah, and then and it gets even more interesting when you go to the other side of the valley towards Codford, because it continues over there.
Yeah.
I mean, that Codford area, we could do a podcast on that area in its own right.
Yeah.
With the circle and various other things.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating area. And actually, it's I think a lot of the finds that have come out of this area are in the archive of Wiltshire Museum in Devizes.
That's right.
So it'd be interesting to go and have a look at those at some point.
Yeah, that's a fantastic museum. I mean, it's I've never really sort of gone in to spend any amount of time in there. In fact, the last time I went in, I think it was just the beginning of lockdown, so in sort of spring last year. God, here we are again, eh? The opening times, I think from memory, it was by appointment only, and they were short staffed as well. They were, in fact, whilst I was there, they had a guy in for interview about a post. I think you could spend all day in there. I think it's a fascinating place.
It is. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to be shown around some of the archives in there. So I've been into the library and seen some of the original first editions of Stukeley's work around Avebury and Stonehenge in his book. And I've been down into the basement and had a look at some of the stuff they've got in boxes. They've got tons of old stones and all sorts of things, all catalogued as well.
And they've got some brilliant old maps as well. And we'll come to this later in connection with Imber, but there's a sort of piece of research I was trying to do, and as I say, it was spring last year, so you know they didn't have many people in, but I was trying to find some old maps, and they were very helpful. And you know, when we're allowed, it'd be great to go back in there and spend some time with the conservator, or whatever the terminology is, and you know, see what they have. But yeah,
yes,
it's a fantastic resource.
It is. It's a great museum, and I think, like many museums at the moment, it's really struggling with the lockdown. So I think they're doing quite a lot of online events at the moment, which you can get tickets for and go and find out stuff about the local area. So I'd really, you know, encourage people to have a look at that.
Yeah, definitely. Just going back to the castle. So that you know more about these things than I do, but Iron Age and then Roman?
Yes. So I think there's a general assumption that a lot of those earthworks in the form of hill forts are Iron Age. And by the time the Romans came along, they were pretty much abandoned, but there were still very often settlements in the area. So, and that's why it's an interesting one with Nook Castle, that you've got those settlements nearby where there's, you know, they found pottery from the Roman period. So it's interesting how the history of the landscape sort of changes. And it's not, when you look at it, it's not, history isn't just a snapshot of one point in time. You're looking at thousands of years in the same spot.
Yeah.
And we can only really guess, you know, how contemporaneous some of these structures are. But it's just interesting to get out there and see them and try and think about their place in the landscape. So should we head up to Imber?
Just before we do, I was just talking about Cunnington and Colt Hoare again.
Yeah.
And sort of and Devizes Museum. I've just looking at a book which I got from what's the name of it? There's a printers in the High Street in Warminster, who it's a fantastic little shop. I mean, you know, books and newspapers, and they even sell proper pens that you can write with, fountain pens and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Brilliant place. But I bought a book called A History of the Villages, Heytesbury, Nook and Titherington. It's mainly about Heytesbury. But it talks about sort of Cunnington and Colt Hoare, but because Cunnington died in 1810, and apparently from all this sort of archaeology that Cunnington and Colt Hoare did, Colt Hoare published a book in 1812 called Ancient Wiltshire, which I guess sort of, you know, it covers a lot of the work that he did and the archaeology and. I don't know if you've ever come across that work. I don't even know if you can find it these days.
No, I've not come across that.
But that must be quite an interesting publication.
Yeah.
But Imber.
Yes, I went to Imber actually because it was open. I'm not. I don't think many people realise this, but it was open in the last few days of the year. Well, when I say open. You know, the buildings, you can't get into them, and the church was closed because of COVID, but you could certainly drive across that part of the Salisbury Plain, which is normally closed to the public for most days of the year.
Yeah. And as you know, I went there on New Year's Day, which has become a bit of a tradition for me. And so I went up this year as normal, and the weather is always filthy when I go.
It's actually snowing when I went.
Yes, very bleak.
Very bleak.
Yes, I had snow as well. Not jumping ahead of ourselves, but when the MOD sort of first moved into the Imber Range back in about in the 1950s, I think it was that they sort of. It wasn't an undertaking, but they basically sort of suggested, or the MOD or the War Office, as it was, suggested that access to Imber should be for a minimum of 50 days a year. And I can remember when I first started going, and it was open probably right throughout August. And so you could pretty much go up any time. And I used to cycle up through there quite a lot. You know, the weather was nice, and you could access a lot more of the byways and stuff and bridleways around there. But over the years since I've been going, access has been sort of restricted more and more. And, you know, as you said, I think it was just open a few days at the end of the year up to end of 2020 up to about the 3rd of January, I think was the last day. And as you said, the church was shut. The buildings had been shut for a long, long time. And in terms of byways and tracks and stuff, I mean, really, it's only two or three roads that you can access. But I wrote a blog about my visit, the 2020 visit for Hidden Wiltshire, beginning of last year. And so I did quite a lot of sort of research at the time, and learned quite a lot of stuff which I didn't know. But that sort of wider area, and we talked about Bowles Barrow earlier, and if you sort of include that in the sort of the slightly wider area, I mean, there's been sort of human activity around there for around 4,500 years. From sort of Neolithic times through Bronze Age, Iron Age, Romano-British. And the village, it was mentioned in the Domesday Book, where it's called, and again, pronunciation here, but Immemerie, I think, I-M-E-M-E-R-I-E. But even before Domesday Book, I mean, it was sort of well established as a settlement before that, in the 10th century.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite sad in some ways, because you can think that humans have occupied that land for thousands of years, but not since the Second World War. We've been banished. In some ways, it's nice that it's preserved for future generations, but it is quite sad that the last human settlements in that area was closed down effectively in the Second World War. I mean, Is it worth just explaining that? Because some people may not know what Imber is, or you want to just talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sort of winding back a little bit. I mean, you look at sort of how the settlement, how the village developed over time. You think back to sort of the Black Death in 1348, when a lot of the country was clearly going through the most awful times, and because of where Imber is, which if anybody doesn't know, it's sort of it's west of the A360 Devizes Road and east of Warminster. So it sits in a very large, what is now a live firing range for the army, and Imber just sort of sits out in the middle of this. But it's always been remote, and so when the Black Death came along and sort of wiped out great swathes of the population, Imber actually got off quite lightly because of its remoteness. It was kind of protected from that. It's like a little island. But then you get sort of the rural unemployment in the early 19th century, and it certainly didn't escape that. And that had a pretty devastating effect on Imber. But then you go up to 1851, when they did a survey of a census, as we would call it now, that was its height, and there were 440 people living there. And then you sort of roll forward to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, and you see photographs, and it was it was a really quite a sort of pretty. It was described at the time as being a pretty village. It was pretty prosperous. I mean, prosperous. Yeah. And it had a post office, school, smithy, pub, shop, two churches, if you include the Baptist chapel, windmill, and there were five farms. And if you go to the village now, and you see Imber Court, really sort of handsome country house. So it was, it was pretty prosperous. But the MOD, or the War Office, sort of moved in around the sort of time of the First World War, and they needed to be in place to train the troops. And the sort of troop concentration sort of built up there. And then after the First World War, they sort of melted away again. But then the sort of the major uptick took place in the approach to the and during the Second World War. That's when it became a very, very active training area for both British and American troops leading up to D-Day. And the village itself had like a sort of 1,000-yard protection zone around it. So the troops weren't allowed to exercise within 1,000 yards of the village. And all of the roads and the access in and out of the village had to be maintained as well. And obviously that became more and more difficult as more and more troops came in. I think the War Office felt that it was becoming really very challenging to keep the villagers safe. And there was a really quite a tragic incident on the 13th of April 1942 when they did a live firing, a sort of firepower demonstration, I guess we call it these days, where they assembled a number of military people as a rehearsal for a visit by Churchill a few days later. And they all assembled to watch a number of Spitfires sort of fly in and fly past, and then followed by six Hurricanes. And the Hurricanes were actually live firing at targets. So it would seem a bit rash now, but they had all these people sort of watching, and they were only something like, I think, about 400 yards from the impact zone. So sort of five Hurricanes came in. They fired off their guns without any sort of any issues, and then the sixth one came in, and it was flown by a. He was either a British or a Canadian pilot. He was only 20 or 21 years old, very inexperienced pilot, and he was dazzled by the sun, and he couldn't see where he was firing. And he fired off two, I think, one-second bursts. But the bullets went into the crowd, and it was just a massacre. There was 25 people killed and 71 injured. And, this guy, the pilot, immediately knew what had happened. He made a mistake, and he can imagine what he felt. 21 years old, and very sadly for him, I mean, just a few weeks later, he was killed on a night flying, attacking targets in Cherbourg, and he sort of went down with his plane. But aside from that, I mean, the village was bombed with incendiaries by the Germans. They think they were trying for because there was so much military activity on the area. And the story goes that somebody hadn't they hadn't you know they used to sort of blank out their headlights, so somebody was driving around there at night, and there happened to be some German aircraft overflying, and the suggestion is they saw the headlights, thinking it was military manoeuvres, and they dropped incendiary devices on Imber. November 1940, there was a German bomber, a Junkers 88, that flew sort of low over the village and then crashed, landed just outside.
I mean, that's extraordinary, because if you think about it, these people are living in a very remote part of the world.
Yeah,
as remote as it can get. They've seen out the Black Death. You know, they've gone through hundreds and thousands of years of history, and then all of a sudden, the world seems smaller because the war has come to their doorstep.
Yeah, yeah. And it all sort of kind of came to a head I've forgotten the date. Yes, 1943, on the 1st of November 1943, the army called a village meeting in the school, and cut into the chase. They basically told the inhabitants that they couldn't ensure their safety anymore. And at this point, there was only around 135 people living in Imber, and they were given 47 days' notice to basically leave the village along with all their possessions. And that meant also having to sell their livestock before they moved out, because sheep farming was a major source of income around there. And they had to sell their livestock. Now, there's some dispute as to whether they were promised that they could return, that there was any sort of such undertaking. I think the War Office later denied it. But the sort of evidence to suggest that certainly verbal assurances were given, if not in writing. And because of that, because people thought that they could come back, there wasn't really any bitterness or very little bitterness. And you know, I get the sense that they thought they were doing this for the sort of the war effort. But as time went by, and you know, the war finished and they couldn't return. In 1948, the War Office basically said that, you know, due to neglect of the buildings and accidental damage that occurred to the buildings, that it would be too costly to reinstate the buildings and repair them. And people pretty much told that, you know, there was no hope of them returning. And I guess when you, well, it doesn't take much imagination, does it? But when you're told that, that's when the bitterness started. And even where I live, I've heard secondhand of stories of people who were children living in Imber at the time. And, they were certainly still to this day very bitter about what happened. And in fact, there was a big, it triggered a decades-long campaign to try and get, you know, the village opened again. But of course, as time went by, and the training out on Imber Range was and still is pretty intense, so the amount of unexploded ordnance out there must be pretty considerable. But in 1961, 22nd of January 1961, there was a big protest rally, and apparently there was something like 700 vehicles collected at place called Gore Cross, which is on the road between Till's Head and West Lavington. So sort of 700 vehicles gathered there, and you know, the occupants, and then they sort of processed out towards the village, and there was sort of 350 vehicle convoy, and you know, a lot of people marching to try and get the at that stage, I don't think it was actually to return to the village, but I think this was on the back of the MOD announcing a permanent closure of rights of way around there. I think that's what triggered the protest rally, and especially when they found out that there were two local hunts who were still able to hunt there, and were able to have shooting parties there. And the thought was, well, if they can go there, why can't we? But as we know, this access has got, as we said earlier on, access has sort of reduced year on year on year. Even in the years I've been going up, I can remember doing a mountain bike race up there, 10, 15 years ago. I can't remember what it's called now, but it was a traditional, it happened every sort of around January. And so, of course, the conditions were horrendous. But we rode on trails around there, which I've never been on since, because now they're just completely inaccessible.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, it has changed, seems to have changed quite quickly in terms of the amount of access. But having said that, the last time I went there a couple of years ago, I wasn't surprised that the MOD were getting spooked, because there were people ignoring the warning signs. They were going into the buildings. Things that were fenced off, people were climbing over. It was horrendous, and imagine the military got very spooked by people not following the guidance.
Well, when I was there last year, January 2020, and I mentioned this in the blog on the Hidden Wiltshire website, I was speaking to some of the landmark guys who were sort of patrolling, and they said they put 60 notices up around the village about not sort of going places, and they were still having to haul people out of the buildings. Can I just share a little story, which again it sort of segue from my blog last year? And there was a chap, Glyn, contacted you, wasn't there? It was a guy called Alan Dodson.
Yes, there was. He contacted me seeking some information, and I put him in touch with you. And then, of course, you had quite a lengthy back and forth with him to try and help him.
Yeah.
But I'll let you tell the story, because it's really quite interesting.
Yeah. So Alan is now in his late 80s, and during the war, his father was posted to Warminster. And so Alan and his family, his mum and his siblings, basically came down to Wiltshire with him, and they lived above a grocer's shop, which is now where the Organ Inn pub is in Warminster. So that used to be a grocer's shop and a fishmonger's, apparently. So Alan and his family sort of rented rooms there, and the grocer's boy, the shop boy, whose name was Terry Bishop, he used to do, I think, I don't know about daily, but he used to do deliveries to Imber from the grocer's shop in Warminster. So he used to drive out there, and Alan would sit in the van with him, and they do the you know, deliver the groceries around the village. And then on the way back, they would go to what Alan described as Auntie's cottage. And Alan, ever since, well, for the last, I don't know, 10 years, he's been trying to identify where Auntie's cottage was. And the reason they went to Auntie's cottage was that she would feed them up. So here's two sort of, you know, one boy and one young man in the war. And of course, everybody was hungry, you know, especially young guys. So she would give them a sort of slap up dinner. So they'd go and get fed there, and then they would continue on their way back to Warminster. So Alan came to us and said, do you think you could help me identify, you know, where Auntie's cottage was? And he doesn't know whether Auntie was Terry's aunt or whether it was just, I mean, you know, even when I was a kid, we used to call like female friends of the family, some of my mum's friends, you know, we call her Auntie this and Auntie that. So whether it was just a sort of family friend, Alan doesn't know. So he's trying to sort of establish where this cottage was. Now, I was in touch with Alan as recently as last night about this, because I thought I'd found it. I'd spent hours sort of reading around in preparation for today, and I looked at this place, and there's some old sort of ruined, there's still a barn there called Ladywell Barn, which is on the road from Imber up the military roads, you know, the concrete road over towards Warminster. And I wondered if it was there. So I sort of got all these old maps and got an old photograph, sent it to Alan, and he came back and said, no, that's not it. But he gave me this sort of very detailed recollection of what the sort of the lay of the land. Now, he reckons it's, and the reason I'm going to some detail, I'm hoping that of the three or four listeners that we have, that somebody might be able to sort of say, oh, I know. Oh, and by the way, sorry, Terry Bishop's wife, he married somebody called Joy Bishop, who until quite recently, and she may well still live in Warminster. Terry died quite some time ago, but Joy until recently lived in Warminster. And Alan Dodson had spoken to her, and Joy remembers this auntie, but couldn't remember where the cottage was or even who she was. Anyway, Alan's given me the sort of quite detailed description, but he does remember that bear in mind they're sitting in a van on very poor roads. They remember driving for about 10 to 15 minutes out of Imber on the way to back to Warminster. Now, we don't know which direction he would have taken. But by the way, this was probably around 1941, 1942, so it's a long time ago. So he remembers going for about 10 to 15 minutes in the van. Now, I was sort of thinking about this. Well, if the van's, maybe it's travelling 15, 20 miles an hour, and in 15 minutes you might get, what, 3 or 4 miles? So I think my next step is to sort of stick a compass in a map and then just draw a circle. Yeah. But bearing in mind, they're going to be heading back to Warminster, so they're not going to be going east towards Tilshead or West Lamington. They're going to be heading the other way. And that's where I've been poring over maps and looking at old sort of tracks. And of course, a lot of the cottages were very poorly built in those days and fell down or were blown up or you know, knocked down or whatever. So you look at the current OS map and there's very little out there in terms of buildings. And of course you can't go out there to look because it's all off limits.
Well, hopefully some local listeners will be able to shed some light on this.
Yeah, it'd be fabulous. I mean, I spoke to Alan last year and he's such a lovely bloke and it would be fantastic to try and sort of help him. But yeah. I'm you know, I was, it was a bit of a knockback last time, and I thought I'd done it. I thought I'd found the auntie's cottage. But let me just say that he did say that he remembers it being a sort of a row of cottages, and there being a spring where they got the water.
Okay.
And now that, for me, narrowed it down a bit. And I think, winding back to last year, I think you, was it you or somebody suggested maybe sort of Luckham and that way, in Luckham Spring. But Alan said, no, I'm pretty certain. The way I described Luckham to him, he said, no, that's not it. But he just...
I mean, that's an interesting one, because there are a lot of springs in that area that pop up. So it may be something that someone more local on the Warminster side may be able to point us to. A lot of these springs, they're known locally, but they're not necessarily well known beyond the villages.
That's right. And that's what led me to Ladywell, because that whole stretch there, there's loads of springs. In fact, it causes pretty serious, what it used to cause pretty serious flooding problems in Bimber, which is why this, where the little Winterbourne that goes through along the main street in Imber is called Imber Dock, because it was rather facetiously, because it, the flooding along there was awful, and it emanated from the springs further up the road towards Warminster, and that's where Ladywell is. Ladywell's right at the junction with the road that goes off ultimately towards Bratton. Anyway, that's not it. So I'm back to thinking that maybe it's in the sort of East Hill Farm direction, Heytesbury, sort of back end of Scratchbury and Battlesbury. You know, that's sort of 3-4 miles away. Ladywell's probably too close. But anyway, he's dismissed that. He's seen the photograph. He said, no, that's not it.
Okay.
So if anybody does know, I mean, they can contact us, I guess, what, through the Facebook group, or can they send us an email through the website?
Yes, they can. I get quite a few emails through the website. Yeah. So there's a contact form on there. So hiddenwiltshire.com, and there's a contact page, and you can zap us an email. Or social media, Facebook. Yeah. Paul and I are on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. So lots of ways to get in touch.
And it's worth mentioning, if people don't know, that if you go to the Hidden Wiltshire website and look under the blogs tab, it's certainly listed episode one of the podcast there. You're going to put two under there as well?
Okay.
Because they're quite detailed show notes. So the show notes sort of, you know, very, very quick sort of recap of what we've spoken about today, but also give you sort of links to, you know, Glyn and myself and to the Hidden Wiltshire website. And also another plug, very quick plug to once again Steve Dixon, who composed and recorded the music for us. You know, there's a link to him on there as well.
Yeah. Just to say on Imber, because I know a lot of people have been asking about this over the last couple of weeks, particularly when they saw some people have been able to get there, because there had been a rumour going around the area that Imber was shut for the whole year, and then there was a little bit of resentment when people saw that some folks were able to get up there. But I always point people to the SPTA newsletter. If you do a Google search for that, every month they give a very good newsletter about what's going on the ranges, what the firing days are, and what access is available.
Sorry to interrupt, but for those that don't know, SPTA stands for Salisbury Plain Training Area.
Yeah. The thing about the SPTA as well is, just to kind of flesh it out a bit more, is there are a lot of byways and tracks and things across Salisbury Plain which have rights of access, but periodically they may close them off because they're doing some military exercises. But that newsletter gives you an up-to-date point of view as to what's open and what's closed. Because you can get into hot water if you venture into somewhere that you shouldn't be.
And I think in a later podcast, because we'll probably sort of do one or two around Salisbury Plain, I can go into quite a lot of detail about access, because through sort of volunteering that I do, I have sort of cards that sort of identification cards that get me access to places that others can't.
Yeah.
Only for very, very specific reasons. But I have to know the bylaws inside out, so I can.
I'd imagine, yeah, the health and safety briefing must be interesting.
Yeah,
I know the last time I ventured up across a road that had been closed for a while, they closed it to clear ordnance.
Yeah.
And after they'd opened it, I went for a walk up there, and I still saw a couple of places where they had these little red flags in the ground, which I assume had been put there to kind of remind the ordnance folks to do a bit of digging. But anyway, it's very real risk. Unexploded stuff up there, which is
I've seen some pretty horrendous photographs, so it is a real threat.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of this podcast, and we can think about the next one actually. So my plan on the next one is to do a tour of the hills above the villages of Bratton and Eddington and the Tin Head area, because there's a couple of, well, there's one or two fantastic walks up there, but as you go on the walk and look at the landscape around there, there's so much of interest. It'd be great to open that up and talk about it and explain the things that we found.
Yeah, and of course, it's just to the north of the area we've been talking about today. So from those areas you can sort of see down into the Imber Ranges. You get a great sort of viewpoint of places you can't walk, basically.
Yes, and we've already mentioned springs, but there's some quite interesting springs around that area as well, which interesting things to hunt out and find.
Don't peek too soon, Glenn. Don't tell them.
I need to hold it back, don't I? I don't want to spoil my surprises. Okay, I think we're done. Thanks everyone for listening, and catch you in 2 weeks.
Yep. Bye for now.